Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections here in the MSU libraries, and I'm pleased to welcome you tonight to another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. The Writers Series is sponsored in part by Schuller Books and Music. As you might have noticed, they have someone here tonight selling books via tonight's writer. So please support Schuller Books and tonight's writer by buying a copy when you should leave, and I'm sure he'll be happy to sign it for you if you should wish. Tonight's guest is Michael Steinberg. Michael Steinberg's most recent book is Still Pitching, a memoir. Other books include the anthology Peninsula, Essays and Memoirs from Michigan, The Fourth Genre, Contemporary Writers of On Creative Nonfiction, and Those Who Do Can. Peninsula was a finalist for the Forward Magazine Anthology of the Year Award and for the 2000 Great Lakes Booksellers Award. Steinberg is the founding editor of Fourth Genre, Explorations in Nonfiction, an award-winning journal of creative nonfiction published biannually by the Michigan State University Press. To date, the journal has won 3 pushcart prizes. A half a dozen pieces have also been cited as notable essays in the Best American Essays annual anthologies. In 2001, the Utney Reader chose Fourth Genre for a Writing Excellence Award. In addition, Steinberg has written and directed several stage plays. In 1984, his co-authored play, I'm Almost Famous, was produced at the Apollo Theater in Chicago. Steinberg has taught writing and creative writing at Michigan State University for over 25 years. In the fall of 1998, he was awarded a National Writer's Voice Writer's Community Residency, and in the spring of 1999, he was the contest judge for the Annie Dillard Award in Creative Nonfiction. I should also add that Mike Steinberg played an instrumental role in getting the Michigan Writers Series off the ground. I believe it was in the summer of 1998 I went to Mike, given his expertise and knowledge about Michigan writers and writing in general, and asked him for his thoughts on beginning a series such as this. He was very forthcoming, very knowledgeable, and he was very instrumental in getting this off the ground, and for that, I thank him very much. Thank you, Mike. The fruits of our labor, I think, can be seen on our website. Going into our fifth year, I believe about between 50 and 60 writers have appeared as part of the Michigan Writers Series. Everything that you hear tonight will be recorded and digitized, so whether you're in East Lansing or in East London, you'll be able to hear readings of the Michigan Writers Series tonight or any other night for the past several years. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce to you, and please join me in welcoming Michael Steinberg.
Thank you for coming out tonight. We're competing with the basketball game, the hockey game, and women's volleyball. So, and you got here. Peter sort of read my own notes in a way. First, I wanted to thank Peter and Stephanie for keeping this series as alive and vital as it is. And it's true, for me, this is a kind of a homecoming. In 1998, as Peter said, he was just about to start up this series, and I remember coming over here and sitting down at a table in the basement with a yellow pad and a pen, and together Peter and I made a list of all the Michigan writers that we could think of. And it was a pretty formidable list, more than I thought. And as this series has kind of borne out, Michigan has some of the finest writers in the country. I also found that out when I edited the anthology that became Peninsula. I had no idea there are that many writers, and writers, you know, good writers here. And there are writers who weren't in that book because it was a nonfiction book. Dozens of them. Well, as Peter said, that was 5 years ago, and now it's my turn to read in the series, and for that I'm grateful, given the people who have preceded me, many of whom, and I've been to a lot of these, are friends and colleagues. This is a high honor for me. Let me give you a little background about Still Pitching, because I really, with a memoir, you can just read a piece of it and hope that the piece of it gives you a sense of the whole. It's a memoir about growing up in New York in the 50s during a period that sports historians and journalists still call the golden age of New York baseball. By that, I mean, except for 1948, during the years 1947 to 57, at least one and more often two of the three New York baseball teams, the Yankees, the Giants, and the Brooklyn Dodgers, appeared in the World Series. It seems impossible to even consider anything like that happening now. Maybe even back then it was. I don't know. But it meant that a New York team won the series 10 times in an 11-year period. And trivia question, 1948, who played and who won? You can tell me that in the Q&A. I don't have a prize. Maybe I do have a prize. Well, the book spans those same 10 years, 1947, and I mark it when Jackie Robinson of the Brooklyn Dodgers broke the Major League color barrier. And then 1957, when the Dodgers and the Giants left New York for California, which marked not only the end of my childhood and the beginning of Major League expansion, but it was the start of a developing awareness that, you know, has grown and grown and grown of changes in the larger culture. I came to it through baseball, other people through other things. But you could sense that there was a shift at that moment. And when you're a kid, it's personal, but it gets much more pronounced as you become an adult. You know, we all marker things from, you know, from our lives. One of them is the Kennedy assassination. That's going to be tomorrow. Well, there are three interrelated stories in this memoir. The front story is the coming of age story. I think that's the story. That's what the book's about. Which, like everybody else's story, and Stephanie and I talked about this in the interview, is about, you know, confusions of family relationships and school and social hierarchies, the vagaries of friendships, and for boys, the mysteries of girls and sex. That's all there. The story number two is of my own personal identification with one of those three teams, and that was the Brooklyn Dodgers. And they were the perennial underachievers of that era. A great team, however, just in the wrong time. The Yankees were better and always better. And that team suffered a lot of misfortune and was very much maligned by fans and sports writers. Think Red Sox, think Cubs. It's the same kind of thing, except the Dodgers actually did win once. But they were a perfect model for a kid like me who saw himself as a congenital outsider and an underdog. And that may be a self-created myth, and it may be true. I don't think I'm going to find out by writing a book, but I can ask the question. But I don't think that's all the Dodgers were. Following Robinson's leadership, actually, he was the persona of the team. The Dodgers really never lost their determination, and it would have been easy to do so, given all the things that happened to them and all the almosts. They did finally beat the Yankees in the 1955 World Series, but then at the end of 1957, they were gone and everything had changed. The third story, and that's the one I'll probably spend time reading tonight, or piece of it, is the one about how I became a baseball pitcher. And as a kid, for a lot of different reasons, baseball became my safe haven, my retreat when everything else went wrong. I think everybody's got one. It was books first, but then it was this. It was a game that, and partly I think it's because of the time and place. It was just everywhere. As a kid, it was a game that I studied, and for some reason I seemed to intuitively understand it, even before I played it. And I played it with a passion, even a desperation, I think, bordering on obsession. Back then, what I wanted more than anything else, like most kids, was to belong, but also at the same time to stand out. And this game gave me the opportunity to do both. So I'm going to read a chapter from that third story tonight. The other two are backstory, and that's why I gave you this information. But I don't think you need to care about or know anything about baseball to understand any of this. It's much more about yearning, about wanting something so badly that you're willing to do just about anything to get it. I'm going to start with three epigraphs that I found as I was writing the book. One is, nothing flatters me more than to have it assumed that I could write prose, unless it is to have it assumed that I once pitched baseball with distinction, and that's Robert Frost in a letter to a fellow poet. I wouldn't have guessed it. The second one is, there is nothing greater for a human being than to get his body to react to all the things one does on a ball field. It's as good as sex, it's as good as music, it fills you up. And that is an ex-ball player, John Buck O'Neill, who played for the old Kansas City Monarchs in the way back in the 40s, 30s. The third one is someone, probably if you just close your eyes and listen to the rhythms and I read it right, that you might recognize, at least people who know poetry might. Baseball is America's game. It has the snap-go fling of the American atmosphere. It belongs as much to our institutions, fits into them as significantly as our Constitution laws. It's just as important in the sum total of our historical life. And that's Walt Whitman, who was given to exaggeration anyway. So I'm going to just read a piece of the prologue, and then I'm going to jump right into one chapter and read the chapter from top to bottom. 1950, an overcast Sunday morning in early June. I'm 10 years old, and I'm standing in our driveway on Beach 132nd Street in Bell Harbor. And this is in Queens, in Rockaway. Our two-story slate gray wood frame house sits between Jamaica Bay, only 100 yards to the west, and the Atlantic Ocean, four blocks to the east. Most of the other homes are brick two stories, like the Ellersteins next door, or split level ranch houses like Frieda Bergman's and the Sloan's across the street. In years to come, these houses would be the backdrop for the marathon stoop ball games my younger brother Alan and I would play all summer long. On this particular morning, my grandmother Tessie, a rotund, stern woman, has just finished serving breakfast. My grandfather Jaime has already left to open up the pharmacy. This being Sunday, my mother is typically still asleep. Out in the driveway, I'm playing catch with my dad. I'm dressed in an oversized New York Giants baseball suit, a uniform I will soon renounce. My father is wearing his own Sunday softball uniform, royal blue tapered cotton pants with white trim down the sides and silver snaps on the bottom. His middle-aged paunch bulges slightly beneath a golden navy nylon jersey with Jerry's Esso scripted across his broad chest. A sky blue cap crowned with a white J covers his bald spot. He looks a lot more imposing than the father I know who dresses in a suit and goes out on the road to sell table linen. As we toss a grass-stained baseball back and forth, I watch our neighbors pass by. They're heading to early mass at St. Francis de Sales. The men and boys are wearing dark suits and ties. The women and girls have on tasteful, conservative, long dresses, their Sunday uniforms. I'm feeling smug now that Hebrew school is out for the summer. When Frankie Carney and Billy Creelman are sitting through boring church services, in a few minutes I'll be headed for Reese Park to watch my dad's team play its customary Sunday doubleheader. A half hour later, I'm on the home team's bench at the Reese Park men's softball field. As the guys on the team slowly gather, in the distance I see families in terry cloth robes and bathing suits eating hot dogs and cotton candy as they stroll the raised boardwalk that runs parallel to the expansive sandy public beach. My father's teammates are warming up for the first game. Most are in their late 30s and early 40s, and they're all wearing uniforms like my dad's. Playing catch and pepper, laughing and kidding around, they look to me like the major leaguers I see on TV. They're so easy and intimate with one another, like they all belong to an exclusive club, a club I ache to be a part of. Just before the first game begins, my heart's racing with anticipation. This week, it's my turn to be bat boy. Last Sunday, Smitty Schumacher's son, Eddie, a pudgy kid with perpetual smudges of dirt on his knees, sullenly performed that chore. To Eddie, this is an annoying obligation, but not to me. When I hand a pine-tarred Louisville slugger to my dad or to Lefty Benton, our stocky blonde first baseman, I feel all tingly inside. And when I watch Smitty glide into the hole between short and third, smoothly backhand a grounder, straighten up and plant his spikes in the dirt, then rifle the ball to Lefty at first, I'm overcome by a catch-in-the-throat sensation that rivets my rubber spikes to the ground. This is the seed of a dream, the beginning of a passionate obsession with baseball that would dominate my childhood and adolescent years, and that would, for better or worse, inform many of the choices and decisions that ultimately shaped my adult self. Okay. I'll read this all in one piece. If you were a competitive athlete, your fate was in the hands of three formidable coaches. Patrolman Joe Blutrich ran the PAL basketball and baseball teams. Tom Sullivan, the junior high phys ed and hygiene teacher, coached the VFW, Veterans of Foreign War, baseball and the Peninsula League football teams, and Jack Kirschman was the high school football and baseball coach. Each had a singular trademark, and each asserted his authority in a different way. Ex-players referred to them as Rockaway's where I grew up, Rockaway's Holy Trinity. Blutrich, the father, was inscrutable and reserved. Sullivan, the son, was a ruthless bigot, and Kirschman, the Holy Ghost, the most powerful and feared of the three, was a disciplinarian and a tyrant. All three were in cahoots with one another. So if you made the PAL and VFW teams, you had a lot better chance of being chosen for the high school varsity, which was, of course, every jock wannabe's dream. I was a baseball player, so I'd have to contend with all three. That is, if I was lucky enough to get that far. The only other alternatives were to transfer to a private school or else give up my dream of playing baseball, neither of which was a viable option. And I'm going to read about the gentle coach. I've read about the tyrants too often. I was hoping that PAL tryouts would be held on the Reese Park Diamonds. I'd virtually grown up on those fields. I knew where every pothole and pebble was, and Reese Park was only a mile from our house. Maybe I could even convince my father to come out and watch. Instead, to my disappointment, Blutrich chose the high school baseball field almost 5 miles away from where I lived. Far Rockaway was the only high school on the peninsula. It was also one of the few city schools to have its own football base and baseball field. That alone gave it some prestige. Though I'd never set foot on the field, in my imagination it already was hallowed ground. In the past 5 years, ever since Kirschman started coaching football and baseball, Far Rockaway had gained a reputation as one of the top sports schools in the city, which of course only added to its mystique. All of us aspirants had dreamed of one day playing on that field. Located in Bayswater, a few blocks up from the L, which is the elevated subway, the high school was a sprawling three-story white brick building with several annexes. The imposing structure was lodged between a lower middle-class neighborhood to the west and a cluster of abandoned houses and weed lots to the east. The playing field was surrounded on three sides by a 20-foot-high chain-link fence. The first thing you saw when you walked through the gate were the football bleachers, the goalposts, and the huge factory-like building looming in the background. As I crossed that threshold, I felt lost and panicky, like I did on the first day of junior high. I became even more flustered when I spotted small gatherings of adults and kids in the third base bleachers, family members and friends of the neighborhood guys who were trying out. It reminded me that no one was here to support me. At breakfast that morning, my mother had diplomatically informed me that my father wouldn't be able to get out of work in time for the tryouts. She assured me that he really wanted to be there, but her tone of voice betrayed her disappointment. I'm sure it was true, but I still felt like I'd been deserted. I was also miffed that she didn't volunteer to take his place. But that was a minor letdown compared to what I'd soon be up against. All the best baseball players on the Rockaway Peninsula had shown up. 50 would compete for 14 roster spots, and half dozen were shortstops. Ever since I watched Smitty Shoemaker, the slick fielding shortstop for my dad's softball team, I'd wanted to be a shortstop. Most shortstops, though, were big and rangy like Smitty was, except that is for Phil Rizzuto, the Yankee shortstop who was only 5'6". In an interview with the Sporting News, Rizzuto said that he'd compensate for his lack of size by cheating a few steps to the left or right, depending on the hitter's stance or swing. The interview also said that Rizzuto carefully scrutinized his catcher's signs so he could anticipate what the pitcher would be throwing. It all made perfect sense to me. As a rule, the team's most versatile infielder is the shortstop. The good ones are acrobatic enough to make the pivot on the double play. They can range far into the hole to their left and right, and they have strong enough arms to throw runners out at first. On most teams, from Sandlot to the pros, the shortstop is the unofficial infield captain. Shortstops are also responsible for covering second on steals and third on bunts, as well as for being the cutoff man on anything that's hit to the outfield. As withdrawn as I was in social situations, I've never been a passive ball player. I like to take charge on the field. I thrive on being right in the middle of things. So I was most at home at shortstop. My main assets were my intelligence, my ability to anticipate, and a strong, accurate arm. Because I could size up hitters, I always knew where to position myself. I watched where they stood in the box, and I observed their stances and mechanics. Did they uppercut or hit down on the ball? Did they have an outside in or an inside out swing? I also paid close attention to the catcher's signals and to the location of his glove. Before every pitch, I'd shade the hitters accordingly, depending on whether the catcher's target was up and in, low and away, low and in, or high and away. Still, I knew I didn't have the size or quickness to compete with Sammy Silverman, Bobby Frankel, or Larry Moshan, the first three shortstops I watched that day. Add to that mix Louis Mandel and Ronnie Zeidner, each of whom had grown almost a half a foot since sixth grade, and there are already five guys who were better than I was. What else could I do then but sit and wait my turn? I'd been observing Coach Blutrich all afternoon, probing to see what I could do to hook his attention. He was a tall, distinguished-looking man, mid-40s, with salt and pepper hair, sharply chiseled features, and slightly stooped shoulders. He was very taciturn, even restrained. He spoke softly and respectfully to his fellow coaches and to all of us kids. Definitely a Gary Cooper type. That illusion's going to play with some people here and not with others. You could see why his former players referred to him as the father. Blutrich's demeanor reminded me a lot of my grandfather, Jaime. Like my grandfather, he had an air of quiet dignity about him. He seemed at ease with himself. My hunch was that you could trust this coach to keep his word. I managed to make it through infield tryouts without distinguishing or embarrassing myself. I handled each ground ball cleanly, my throws to first were right on the money, and I even turned the pivot neatly on the double play, but I knew I was mostly playing for myself. I didn't stand a chance of making the team, even as a reserve infielder. After my turn, then, I sat alone in the bleachers, brooding about what a long summer it was going to be, working 5 days a week at the pharmacy, having no social life to speak of, and dreading having to start eighth grade with nothing to look forward to but another year of anonymity. I tried to resign myself to that inevitability. I'd made the best showing I could under the circumstances. Still, I couldn't shake off my disappointment. Hitting tryouts were the last hurdle of the day. I'd never been much of a hitter, so things weren't going to go any better for me. After each batter took his turn, I'd watch Blutrich take him aside and quietly inform him of his fate. You could tell by the body language and the looks on faces who'd made the cut. By the time I came up to bat, I already know who the team was. Bobby Brownstein and Ronnie Zeidner, the two best athletes in junior high, were shoo-ins. I was also pretty certain that the three Bayswater guys, Silverman, Frankel, and Moshan, would make it all the way. They're all good enough, but I bet it didn't hurt that they were starters on Blutrich's PAL basketball team. I was secretly pleased, though, that not one guy from the junior high clique was chosen, not even Louis Mandel. But I was mildly surprised that Blutrich kept Barry Aronson, an awkward, rangy kid who lived five blocks from my house. Barry was only a sub on the sixth grade softball team, but he was one of the best players on our synagogue's basketball team. Who knows, maybe Blutrich was doing a little advanced recruiting for next winter. The big shock was that my best friend and rival Mike Rubin made the first cut. As soon as I saw the look of joy on his face, I felt a manic surge of envy. It had occurred to me more than once that I probably would have had a better chance if I tried out for third base, But third base was Mike's position, and I didn't want to have to compete with him again, which happened in sixth grade, and we didn't talk to each other for about 6 months. After tryouts, I trudged over to the third base bleachers where Bluechurch was standing writing the final notes on his clipboard. I swallowed hard as he gave me the news. He was kind about it, but he still told me in no uncertain terms that I didn't have the reflexes to be a middle infielder, nor, he added, did I hit well enough to play the outfield. No surprises there. I knew all along it was coming. But now it was real, final. The prospect of not playing ball this summer was too excruciating to even contemplate. My face was flushed with shame and my ears were still ringing when I looked up and spotted a cadre of guys, Ruben among them, celebrating right outside the gate. I wished I could just slip away without having to face the music. Then, in a split second, I knew exactly what I had to do. Why hadn't I thought of it before? The only decent pitcher I'd seen all day was Lee Adnepose, a slender, wiry left-hander who just moved into our neighborhood. Lee was even shorter than I was, but he looked like someone had taught him how to pitch. He had a smooth three-quarter overhand delivery, a nice easy leg kick, and a fluid, graceful follow-through. He even had a toe plate on his left shoe. Whenever Lee threw a fastball in the strike zone, hitters either whiffed or topped the ball off the end of the bat. So far as I could tell, his only weakness was erratic control, and that was because he sometimes got bored and lost his concentration. All day I wondered where the other good pitchers were. Bluechurch must have a few other studs lined up. Probably they'd show up tomorrow after the first round of cuts. This was going to be a desperate gamble, I knew, but it was my only shot. I waited until everyone had drifted away. While Bluechurch was picking up the bats, I walked right up behind him. When he turned, he was a little startled to see me still standing there. "Coach," I said, trying to keep my voice from cracking, "I know how to pitch." Actually, it was more of a fib than an outright lie. I was thinking about those marathon stickball games in Mike Rubin's driveway and the winter afternoons when I pitched to Mike and Peter DeSimone in the PS114 gym, and the times I used to throw to my kid brother in the backyard when he was just learning how to hit. And what about the schoolyard pickup games? I could always throw strikes, so in time I became the designated batting practice pitcher. I'd probably put in more time pitching than I had at shortstop, in fact. Yet until this moment, I never thought of myself as a pitcher. Bluechurch looked away while I held my breath. I could sense that he was thinking about it. He turned slowly toward me, shaking his head up and down like he was having a private conversation with himself. He was probably wondering if this short, chubby, unathletic-looking kid was for real. Finally, he said, "I can use a batting practice pitcher." I exhaled. Maybe the coach had seen the same thing today as I had. Maybe there really were no other pitchers waiting in the wings. If that was so, aside from Lee and Ronnie Zeidner, who was also Bluechurch's best shortstop, there wasn't much to choose from. Besides, when you thought about it, what could he lose by taking on a batting practice pitcher, especially one who volunteers? For a second, I wished my father had been there to witness this. He'd have been proud of my gumption. "Show up tomorrow morning," Bluechurch said. The next day, Bluechurch gave me an old faded uniform with patches on the knees of both pant legs. For a minute, I felt like an imposter. I had 6 days to make myself into a reasonable facsimile of a pitcher. At 13, I was what baseball coaches called a schlepper, a slightly awkward but not entirely inept athlete. I knew I'd never be one of the top baseball players. I'd seen a lot of games, and I could spot the good jocks in an instant. They have an effortless grace, an ease and fluidity that infuses every gesture. I'd never have that kind of raw ability. Still, I was driven to play ball. That summer, I literally taught myself how to pitch. I read dozens of how-to books, and I scrutinized the mechanics and flaws of the major league hitters I watched on TV and in person. I went to Ebbets Field and I sat directly behind the plate, the best angle for studying pitchers' habits and delivery. And I took pages and pages of notes. Preacher Rowe was tall and lanky, all arms and legs. He had a big sweeping motion and a high leg kick that shielded the ball from the batter's vision. Don Newcomb was built like a lumberjack. He had a 90-mile-an-hour fastball and a perpetual scowl designed to intimidate opposing hitters. But Carl Erskine was the Dodger pitcher I identified with most. He had a slender build, narrow shoulders, and a tapered waist. He looked more like a distance runner than a pitcher, but he threw a sneaky fastball and a wicked overhand sinker that induced hitters to beat the ball into the ground. I noticed, too, that he threw all his pitches, including the changeup, with the same motion. What made him so effective was that hitters couldn't pick up the ball's rotation until it was right on top of them. And I liked his cunning and resilience. In a Sporting News interview, an opposing manager said that unless you got to Erskine right away, you were in for a long day. But even when he got roughed up in the early innings, I noticed that Erskine rarely lost his composure. Usually, he'd settle down by the third inning. Just like the article said, he'd get stronger as the game went on. That summer, I studied him more carefully than the others. When workouts began, Blutrich kept his word. He started me off as a batting practice pitcher. There were other pitchers ahead of me besides Lee. By now, he had found other guys. They all threw harder than I did. It didn't take much to do that. But none of them were very savvy, nor did they seem interested in learning anything about the craft of pitching. Lee and I were the only pitchers who practiced in between scrimmages. It wasn't long then before Blutrich began giving me more innings in the inter-squad and preseason games. There were brief moments when pitching seemed to come naturally to me. If I concentrated hard enough, I could throw strikes, change speeds, make the ball sink or break sharply away from the batter. I even had a knack for sizing up a lot of hitters' weaknesses. I could tell what a particular batter's blind spots were just by studying his habits and mannerisms. As a pitcher, my inhibitions and self-doubts seemed to dissolve. Whenever I was out on the mound, I felt as self-assured as I did when I was sitting in the stands at Ebbets Field explaining the ins and outs of the game to my cronies. Every new inning, every new batter was a challenge. On the mound, all of my senses were open. I could feel the warm breeze on my cheeks, hear the muffled noise of the crowd, my teammates' chatter, and the other team's barbs. But none of it distracted me. In fact, it made me bear down harder. Even the little gestures and rituals felt natural, tossing the spongy rosin bag nonchalantly to the ground and watching the swirl of dust kick up, inhaling a baseball's pungent scent, rubbing up its smooth, slick surface. I also loved the feeling of wrapping my thumb and middle fingers around the ball's raised seams, searching for the right grip on a curve, fastball, sinker, or changeup. Most of all, I relished the cat and mouse game that went on between pitcher and hitter, me deciding what pitches to throw, the hitter trying to read my mind. I didn't throw hard enough to have what coaches call a live arm. To build my strength and endurance, each morning I got up early and ran on the beach, wearing army boots and a rubber jacket. During the day, I pedaled my bike harder when I delivered prescriptions. After work, I'd go down into our cool, damp cellar and lift weights. Even in the hottest weather, I emulated the big leaguers by draping a satin warm-up jacket across my right shoulder. Whenever anyone made a sarcastic remark or questioned me about it, I'd explain that it was to keep my pitching arm warm between ball games. In the evenings, I set up a regular practice routine. First, I cut a 12-inch hole, 12 inches the size of home plate, in a bed sheet and hung it on the backyard clothesline. Then every night until it got dark, I threw hundreds of rubber-covered baseballs at that target. I got those balls by trading my Topps and Bowman bubblegum cards with Arnold Berkowitz, who worked at the local batting range. By mid-July, I could throw 4 out of every 5 pitches through the bedsheet hole. By the end of the summer, I could throw 3 of 5 with a blindfold on. Some evenings, my brother Alan stood in front of the garage door with a bat in his hand while I pitched shaved tennis balls to him. By trimming the ball's fuzz, you could make it break and dip crazily. One night, when I was pitching to my brother, the 4 guys in the clique, always my enemies, happened to walk past my house. They're on their way to a party up the street. But when they spotted Alan and me, they slowed down long enough to make a couple of snide cracks about playing their own night games. I didn't respond, but I was thinking, keep it up, guys. Someday you and your stuck-up girlfriends will be paying a half a buck to watch me play. The more I worked at pitching, the more instinctive it felt. By midsummer, it was as natural to me as reading a book. I was convinced that with the right guidance and coaching, I could get a lot better at this. In the early season games, Bluechurch was hesitant to use me. You couldn't blame him. I was inexperienced, and I still couldn't throw very hard. In fact, my ex-high school teammate, Andrew McCreadys, to this day, and I mean to this day, still ribs me about it. Got a phone call last night. You had three speeds, Mike, Andrew said. Slow, slower, and slowest. And your sinker was a dying quail. You were lucky the pitcher's mound was 60 feet 6 inches from home, because if somebody ever moved it back a half a foot, your pitchers would have bounced in the dirt before they got to the plate. But I continued to pitch well and with confidence in all the practice and inter-squad games, and I looked pretty good whenever I got a few innings in preseason exhibitions. Still, no one could predict how I'd fare in a league game. A lot of players look great in practice, and then they get rattled when the games really count. For the first few weeks, Bluechurch experimented with Ronnie Zeidner as his second pitcher. Zeidner was even better than Lee, but he was also our best hitter and shortstop. It's hard to pitch and play shortstop. There's a big difference between throwing 100-plus pitches from 60 feet 6 inches away and making a half a dozen long throws from short, not to mention the different mindset that each position requires. After the first few games, we could all sense that we had the talent and chemistry to contend for the Borough Championship. Bluechurch also knew that our strongest lineup was with Lee or someone else pitching and Zeidner at short, especially when we played the better teams. As we approached the halfway point in the season, I'd only pitched a few innings of middle relief, mostly in games that were blowouts. But none of the other pitchers that Bluechurch had added were especially effective either, including Bert Levy, another kid from our neighborhood. Bert was big and husky, and he could throw good heat, but he had a tendency to get spooked with men on base. I was getting antsy to show Bluechurch what I could do. Let's face it, he was going to have to pitch me sooner or later. We must have been thinking the same thing, because right at the beginning of the second round, he took me aside after practice and told me to just be patient. He'd work me in as a second starter once the schedule got heavy. A good coach has to be part psychologist and part tactician. Coaches always want their players on edge. That's why they rarely tip their hand when it comes to who plays and who sits. There's a fine line between keeping a bench warmer's spirit alive and breaking his will. No doubt there's a certain amount of expediency in Bluechurch's promise. But just the fact that he took the trouble to inform me settled me down, and it gave me even more incentive to prove that his faith in me was justified. As he'd promised, Bluechurch started me in the next game. It was the vote of confidence I was waiting for. It's an old cliche, but when opportunity and preparation meet luck, good things happen. That day, I pitched 5 shutout innings before I got tired. I left with a 6-run lead and 2 men on base. Levy relieved me, and I sat on the bench chewing my nails to the quick, hoping he wouldn't blow my lead. Bert gave up 4 runs before he got out of the inning. Zeidner pitched the 7th and set them down 1-2-3. We were lucky to win. Bert's failure to come through, though, worked in my favor. It made me look even better in Bluechurch's eyes. By early August, I'd improved so much that I even took Bluechurch by surprise. At the end of the league season, Lee and I were pitching every other game. To chart my progress, I recorded my game stats in a spiral notebook, along with the notes I'd made on opposing hitters and pitchers. After each game, I wrote a detailed description of what I was thinking and feeling before, during, and after each inning. I specified what pitches and strategies had worked and hadn't worked, and I described in detail the adjustments I planned to make next time. I even noted what I ate before the game and how much sleep I got the night before. I loved writing in my notebook almost as much as I relished pitching the actual games. When I think back, my happiest childhood moments seem to involve either writing, reading, or playing baseball. Our team moved through the rest of the season in a playoff elimination round without a loss. In the borough championships, we would face the 102nd precinct from Richmond Hill in a best 2 out of 3 playoff. The first 2 games would be played on successive days on each team's home field. The third, if necessary, was scheduled for the following weekend on a neutral site, Franklin K. Lane High School on the Brooklyn-Queens border. To everyone's surprise, especially mine, Blutrich started me in the first game. It was just as well he didn't tell me in advance because I've had too much time to dwell on it. All during warm-ups, I noticed that Lee sat on the bench scowling at me as if to say, "What the hell are you doing out there, Peckerhead? This game is mine." I tried to block the image out of my mind, but I was so shaken I kept losing my concentration. I gave up 3 early runs before settling down in the third inning. I was angry at myself for losing focus in such a big game. Once I regained my confidence, I didn't give up another run. Luckily, we rallied and won at 5-3. I was glad I'd come through for Blutrich, but I was a little disappointed that no one from my family showed up to watch. My most pressing concern, though, was Lee. He was ticked off, never even said nice game on the bus ride back. What could he be thinking about me and about Blutrich? Was he doubting his own ability? Even I believed that he hadn't gotten a fair shake. After all, Lee had carried us for the whole first half of the summer. Lee was scheduled to start in the next game at home. Normally, we talk about how to pitch to the opposing hitters. During warm-ups, though, he went out of his way to avoid me. Can't say as I blame him. Had I been in his place, I probably would have acted the same way. When the game started, I was sitting on the bench charting Lee's pitches, and I could see right away he was still unnerved by yesterday's events. He was wild and inconsistent. He put men on base every inning. More times than not, we managed to bail him out, but we finally lost 5-4 on a 7th-inning bases-loaded walk. You could feel that one coming for the entire game. It's the last segment. Blutrich had 6 days to decide who would pitch the rubber game. It felt so strange to be on this end of the transaction. As much as I wanted that game, and as much as I wanted us to win, I'd have almost preferred it if Blutrich had chose Lee instead of me. I didn't want that weight sitting on my shoulder again. All week, though, I had a hunch it was going to be me. "Worry about yourself, not the next guy," my father counseled. He was right. I needed to focus on my game plan. If I worried about Lee's feelings, I'd be sabotaging my own chances. On Saturday, right after infield practice, Blutrich handed me the ball. By now, I was getting a vague sense of where all this was headed. Coaches used you not because they wanted to give you a fair chance, but because they thought you could help them win games, and you put up with them because you wanted to play. During warm-ups, I didn't dare look at the bench for fear that I'd see Lee. But when I spotted my father and brother in the stands, I became even more unglued. I gave up a run in each of the first 2 innings. We lost the game and the championship 2-1. I gave up only 5 hits, and I struck out 10 batters, the most I'd ever gotten in a game. Every pitch I threw had something on it, but that was the problem. The ball was moving so much that I didn't have my usual control. I gave up 5 walks, 2 to leadoff hitters who eventually came around to score. If I were a pitching coach, my first piece of advice to a new pitcher would always be, never walk the first batter of an inning. It'll always come back to bite you in the ass. But even with the final loss, I'd succeeded way beyond my original expectations. Despite the concentration lapses, I'd pitched my 2 best games right at the end when it really counted, and I finished both of them. I didn't want to get too hyped up about it, though, because it was only a first step. VFW tryouts were 9 months away. I'll wind up here. That same summer, with a little bit of the second story, which is the Brooklyn Dodgers story, that same summer, 1953, the Dodgers beat the second-place Milwaukee Braves by 13 games. Their 105-49 record was the best in team history, and their 208 home runs were the second-highest total in baseball history. It was the 5th consecutive season they'd led the league in home runs, the 8th consecutive year they were first in stolen bases. But if that wasn't enough, Brooklyn compiled a .285 team batting average. Carl Farrella won the batting title with a .344 average, and 4 other players hit over .300. And yet, in the World Series, the Yankees beat the Dodgers in 6 games. It was the 5th consecutive year that the Yankees had won the World Championship, and the 7th time in a row they'd beaten the Dodgers. According to the press, the Dodgers' 0-7 World Series record was a major embarrassment. Until they beat the Yankees in the series, they'd continue to be judged as also-rans and underachievers. It was an unfortunate coincidence that such a talented and determined team was peaking at the same time that the great Yankee teams of that era were winning one championship after another. Any other decade, Brooklyn would have already won several World Series. As the game was teaching me, the world worked in strange ways. Regardless of their track record in the series, or perhaps even because of it, my bond with the Dodgers that season got stronger and more intense. Like me, they still had something to strive for, something left to prove. Thank you. We can do Q&A. I'll take whatever questions you have, and I can outweigh you because I'm a teacher. Bruce.
Start with the title.
Still pitching. Yeah. It was the title of a longer book in which I was trying to draw an arc between being a pitcher, especially relief pitcher, finally in high school, who finished every game, and becoming a writer, because as a writer, you finish what you write. You stay there until you get it done. And I saw a lot of similarities in the two. But when I wrote the book, it was way too big. And so one thing led to another, and I was able just to take those 10 years in childhood, which was a real, I'd say a lucky break for me, but it took 3 years to figure it out. 3 years of writing the wrong book to figure out the right book, but the wrong book was the right book. You know how that is. And I kept the title because in the end, I still think this is mostly about wanting and yearning and determination and, you know, so one way or another, I'm still doing that. And even though it's a childhood book, it's pretty clear that the person who wrote it is a writer, so he must still be doing something the same way he did when he was a kid. So that's the title. Yes. Oh, gee, that's a hard question. I'm not the reader. What I want to get out of a book that I have no, let's say I have no knowledge of the subject, I have no real experience doing it. It may even be foreign to me. It may even be something I don't like. But I think it, especially in memoir, the subject is not as important as what the writer actually makes out of the subject, you know, what connection he or she might make. I always want, when I read, especially, you know, creative nonfiction, but certainly when I read fiction and poetry, I always want to somehow find the connection between that writer's story and mine. And usually it's in here. It's not about whether someone played baseball or didn't. In this case, it's about wanting and not getting, and then trying harder, and then being disappointed, and then, you know, and then you go through that struggle, I think, with everything that you want your entire life. I certainly know I do. Nothing really changes except the fact that you know this is a constant. This is the way it's going to be the rest of the way if you're lucky enough to get that far. And so I guess I'd want a reader to get somehow beneath the surface of baseball somehow. What do you do as a reader that fascinates you that just so much that you think in some ways maybe, I don't know if you were born to do it, but it comes naturally to you. You seem to be able to learn it easily. It animates you when you do it. I think everybody's got something. Mine happened to be baseball. I can't tell you exactly why, but it had a lot to do with not fitting in other places or wanting to be recognized and popular. You know, when you're 13 years old, nobody pays any attention to you except to discipline you or to tell you what you can't do. And, you know, as a baseball player with the ball in my hand on the mound, you know, different feeling. You're in charge for those few innings because it's your show. And other people watch. And when you're young, that's powerful. It's a powerful incentive. But it's always a dream. You don't know if you're going to get it or not. But it did teach me that those are the things I should pay attention to, those impulses, to follow them as best I could, you know, as long as I could. I can't say I succeeded at it, but it's what guided me. I'm pretty sure that was a shaping influence. I don't think I would have written about it. So, yes, in the back. God forbid. After writing the book, did I go back and talk to my old coaches? Well, I don't know where two of them are. Certainly don't know where this guy is. The second coach, who was one I had a violent confrontation with, it was dangerous, actually, for me and for him. I don't know where he is either. The third coach is still alive, and he's the most prominent in this book, and there's no doubt he's going to find out about it because half the baseball team from my high school has already emailed me. I don't know where they found this yet. I think I'm going to put it up on the website now that it's out. And they've been saying, well, you know, aren't you going to show this to the coach? And I thought, no, not really. I'm not even interested in showing it to him. Because I don't know what his sense of who he is in my book is. You know, it's my version of him. When I talked to him in 1998, he didn't even remember half the things that he did. He thought he was this mellow old guy who, you know, everybody loved. So if I get to be that age, maybe that's the way I'll see myself. He's going to catch up with me one way or another, I think. So, yes, Linda. I stopped pitching, and I could tell you exactly when. When I came to graduate school here at Michigan State, I'd run out of places to pitch. I'd run out of scholarships. I'd run out of leagues. And I came here, you know, seriously thinking I was on the way to a master's degree in English and a PhD, which I got, but baseball didn't accelerate the process a lot. I didn't think about it until I started going out and watching the City League games. I lived in Marriott Housing, you know, in right on Kalamazoo, maybe, I don't know, 1,000 yards from the municipal park, the baseball field, and I could see the lights every night. So I went out, started watching games, and one thing led to another, and I was out there pitching, you know, and not doing real well in school. But I could see that if I didn't pay full attention to this, to the pitching, it wasn't going to happen. And I didn't have, I had the desire, I just didn't have the focus. It was going to be graduate school, I was newly married. And baseball's always been an obsession. If it took me over again, it was going to take me, and I wasn't going to get through school. So I stopped that year, and I was really proud of myself. But the next year, I started playing fast-pitch softball, and I played that for 20 years, so it almost negated it. It was, you know, I didn't play it with the same amount of preparation and passion, but it took time. And I can say probably a lot of books didn't get written. A lot of things didn't get done in those years, but I got no regrets. So, yes.
A lot of my friends and one of the younger people there are here because I'm in a class and this is an original. And one of the themes of the class is identity. So we're all kind of like desperate to scramble the times and this is like one of
my own. Amen.
How would you compare the identity shift between identifying yourself as a shortstop and a pitcher to that shift between like becoming a baseball player?
I would say not so much the shift from playing shortstop to pitching. That was desperate. I want to make the team. It's about identity in that not making it that team at that moment in my life would have hurt more than trying and failing. I think that about everything. And memoir is about identity. You somehow look back on what the influences were that shaped you, but it's about what shaped you today, how you became who you are now. You're always looking back. You're never going to know more about yourself than you do right now until tomorrow. So when you're writing about your past, and looking for things that, you know, that shaped your identity, they're going to be different than mine. But what we have in common is that's what we're looking for. We're trying to make sense out of how we got where we, how'd you get here? You know, I know the class told you to show up in the library, but I mean, there's a bigger journey here. And so we all, in writing memoir, I feel we give our own version of not our lives so much, but of what questions we can't answer. And the question that I couldn't answer is, how did I get here? How did this kid who did this, this, and this become, you know, a writer, a writing teacher, you know, a whole bunch of other things? What were the shaping influences? And in my own mind, which is as much as saying my own imagination, my own mythology, these are the things I believed were the most important shaping influences. Yeah, my family was. You know, I wrote a childhood memoir and left them out. My brother is going to kill me because, you know, he's my brother. He was there. And everybody's version of your story is going to be different. There are people already saying to me, I can't figure out a word of this. None of this ever happened. Well, it happened to me. It's the way I remember it. And I guess, you know, who you are is a result of a lot of complex things that you'll never really know. But it doesn't stop you from asking. I believe that's sort of what drew me to writing, you know, creative nonfiction, is those questions are the questions that you can ask legitimately. You could, as a lyric poet, I suppose, as a fiction writer, be a lot harder, because you're inventing a different kind of world when you do that. So, it was to me from the beginning, it was all about that. I think at a point in your life, you say, this is it. I found what I'm looking for, or you haven't found it. But the whole point of it is to see if you can find what that is. And sometimes you don't know what it is until you got it. No idea. I mean, I had no idea that it was going to turn out to be a writer. I knew I wasn't going to play center field for the Yankees. I mean, not big enough, not strong. But I didn't know that any of these things would happen. And so I suppose, what if these things were most important? And then, too, when I write, these things keep coming back to me like obsessions. And much as I sweep them away and say, this is really not important, I should be writing adult stuff, that's what comes back. So that's where I have to go. And I'd say whatever the hot buttons are and what you do, that's where your identity's at. You go for it. So. Other questions for those of you who are still awake? Yes. Yes. Going once, going twice. I think we're done. Thanks.